Good morning. Have you ever heard the saying, everyone has a twin? Ever heard that? This weekend, we had the opportunity, the three older kids went to my parents' house this weekend, and so Karen and I and Oakley, Friday night, went over to Fort Wayne, and we did a little bit of shopping, and then decided to go out to eat at Chili's, eat some good food. And as we were sitting there, I was, just doing stuff, talking with Kara, feeding Oakley, and doing different things, and I look over diagonal to me, and I'm like, man, if Fred Brandon had a twin, that guy is Fred Brandon's twin. And I even said to Kara, you can ask her, I even said, Kara, look at that guy. Isn't that Fred Brandon's twin? I should take a picture and show him. And guy had a hat on and just looked like Fred Brandon. I'm like, man, everybody has a twin. It's so true. Got here this morning, Fred walked in, and he was getting some coffee. He was like, hey, Brent, I got to tell you something. I was at Chili's the other night, and you have a twin. He's like, I even took a picture of it to show you. And I was like, Fred, I was at Chili's the other night, and you have a twin. Let me just say this. Sometimes that twin might actually be the real person. As Fred and I found out, we were both thinking, man, this guy, it just looks just like him, but we're not sure. You know, it threw Fred off. We only had one kid with us, so we didn't have three other ones running around and terrorizing the restaurant. And so it's just like, man, we just laughed about it this morning. As I thought about it this morning during worship, it just brings a smile to my face because it's so funny how, and it's just, I was thinking, what are the odds? You know, we're in Fort Wayne, we're in the same restaurant there. It's just got to be a guy that looks just like him. He had a hat on, so I wasn't sure. And no, sure enough, we were both sitting just diagonal, one seat over, and we're like, man, both thought we had a twin, and which is a good segue into what we're talking about today, because we're going to be talking about the resurrection. And some people might have thought, hey, Jesus has a twin. No, it's the real thing. It's the real deal. There was a Seattle airport cargo handler who was unloading pets with some of his friends, and they found one of the dogs had died, and they panicked. So they just made something up. They told the owner that his dog had been misrouted to Phoenix. Come back tomorrow and we'll give you your dog. That gave them time to go to the pound to find a dog that looked similar to this man's dead dog. They found one and brought it back. But when they gave it to the man, he said, that's not my dog. They said, well, sure it is. He looks a little different, but that's just jet lag. He had a long trip. The man said, I know that's not my dog. They went back and forth, and finally they asked him, how do you know this isn't your dog? And the man said, because my dog was dead. I was shipping him back to be buried. Things don't normally come back to life, right? But there was one event that happened 2,000 years ago that literally changed the course of history. Something happened that had never happened before. I recently heard a story of a man and his wife and her mother who went on a vacation to the Holy Land. And while they were there, the mother-in-law had passed away. The undertaker told them, you can have her shipped home for $8,000. Or you could have her buried here in the Holy Land for $150. Well, the man thought about it and said that they would just have her body shipped home. The undertaker asked, why would you spend $8,000 to ship your mother-in-law home when it would be wonderful to have her buried here and only spend $150? The man replied, a man died here 2,000 years ago, was buried here, and 3 days later rose from the dead. I just can't take that chance. I'll have to call my mother-in-law up later this afternoon and tell her that one. She'll get a kick out of that one. A couple thousand years ago, something happened that had never happened before. A few broken-hearted people went to the tomb of a man they loved, a man who had just recently died, a man who they had watched soldiers crucify and pierce. They were told by a shining angel that he wasn't there, the tomb was empty. He is not here, he has risen. that one fact, that single piece of news is much more important than anything else that has ever happened in the history of the world. To this day, all human history is roughly divided into BC, what happened before him, and AD, what happened after him. The reason for that is not simply that the tomb was empty. It wasn't so much about where Jesus wasn't. It was about where Jesus was. In John chapter 20, verse 19, it says, "On the evening of that first day of the week, when the disciples were together with the doors locked for fear of the Jewish leaders, Jesus came and stood among them and said, 'Peace be with you.'" All of a sudden, Jesus was with them. He was letting them know, now you have no reason to live, or you have a reason to live and a reason to die. And you have a reason to hope beyond all life and all death. All of a sudden, he was with Mary. He was communicating to her, "You don't have to go through life being afraid anymore. Not of anything, not even death." All of a sudden, he was with Peter, saying in essence, "You don't have to go through life feeling guilty anymore because you failed so often. Not even because you failed me by denying me before I died, because I'm restoring you." Then he was with Thomas, and his message was, "You don't have to go through life doubting anymore. Not about God, not about me. You can live with faith and hope and joy." Now that's good news. But is it true news? If it's true, then the resurrection means that your past is not unforgivable, no matter what you've done. So if you need an injection of hope and this is the true news, then this is very good news. This morning we're going to look at some of the evidence for the resurrection. The Apostle Paul wrote this in 1 Corinthians chapter 15, 14. If you have the slides, go ahead and... There we go. 1 Corinthians 15, 14. "And if Christ has not been raised, if none of that had happened, our preaching is useless and so is your faith." It's useless. Michael Green put it this way in his book, Man Alive. "Christianity does not hold the resurrection to be one among many tenets of beliefs. Without faith in the resurrection, there would be no Christianity at all. The Christian church would never have begun and the Jesus movement would have fizzled. Christianity stands or falls with the truth of the resurrection. Once you disprove it, you have disposed of Christianity. Everything hinders on it." If you go to the Guinness Book of World Records, you'll find the most successful lawyer in history was a man named Sir Lionel Lutcow. He won 245 successive murder acquittals as a defense attorney. He's a guy I'd want on my team if I ever had to go to court. I'd stay out of court, but if I ever had to, I'm looking him up. He was knighted twice by Queen Elizabeth, and he was appointed Queen's Counsel to conduct court work on behalf of the crown. Wouldn't it be cool if we could have the legal opinion of a towering intellect like Sir Lutcow to help us answer life's toughest riddles? Well, one day, someone did exactly that. They challenged him to take his legal skills and apply them to the evidence of the resurrection. He spent several years studying the historical records. And he finally summarized his conclusion with this: "I say unequivocally that the evidence for the resurrection of Jesus Christ is so powerful that it compels acceptance by proof, which leaves absolute no room for doubt." Sir Lutcow became a Christian at age 64 as a result. That's an amazing statement, an amazing testimony. I want to take a few minutes this morning and go through the evidence that Sir Lutcow would have investigated. And the first one is the evidence of the empty tomb. In Luke chapter 24, verses 6 through 7, it says this: He is not here. He has risen. Remember how you how he told you while he was still with you in Galilee? The Son of Man must be delivered over to the hands of sinners, be crucified, and on the third day be raised again. Here are some of the objections to the resurrection that people have come up with. And here are a few easy ways to refute those objections. And objection one is the swoon theory. First proposed in the 1800s, this theory states that Christ never really died. That the reason he got out of the grave was because he was never really dead to begin with. Interesting. The shock from the loss of blood on the cross, his wounds and all that he suffered sent him into a semi-coma. When they took him off the cross and put him in the tomb, the aroma of the spices and the coolness of the tomb revived him. This theory states that when he came out of the grave, the disciples assumed that he was resurrected. If this theory is true, it means that Jesus successfully survived severe beating and loss of blood, crucifixion and further loss of blood, the spear thrust into his side, again draining the blood out of his body through a gaping wound. He survived entombment with 75 pounds of spices on his already weakened body. He survived 3 days with no food or water. He woke up without any medical assistance ever after having lost most of his blood, stood up in his mummy-like grave cloths, which by now would have hardened around his body like plaster, moved the stone, overpowered highly trained Roman guards carrying shields, daggers, and javelins, walked 7 miles to Emmaus on feet that had been pierced with nails, convinced everyone that he was fine alive from dead. Any questions? So that's the swoon theory. Objection number two is the stolen body theory. Some say Jesus couldn't possibly have risen from the dead. There's not a chance. That kind of stuff doesn't happen. The body had to have been stolen. All right, then. The question is, who stole it, right? Matthew 28, verses 12 through 15, it says, when the chief priests had met with the elders and devised a plan, they gave the soldiers a large sum of money, telling them, you are to say that his disciples came during the night and stole him away while we were asleep. If this report gets to the governor, we will satisfy him and keep you out of trouble. So the soldiers took the money and did as they were instructed. And the story has been widely circulated among the Jews this very day. This theory results in three possibilities. First, the Roman government stole the body. Second, the Jewish authority stole the body. In both of these scenarios, the two groups have absolutely no motive. They would have loved to produce a body. It would have crushed the growing movement of Christianity, which they desperately wanted to put out of extinction, their existence. It would have saved the Roman authorities a lot of time, money, and effort, and having to pursue even more Christians so they could persecute them. Third, the disciples stole the body. When you think about it, they have absolutely no motive either. They were not highly motivated to have the unspeakable privilege of living as penniless evangelists, wandering around for the rest of their lives, being beaten, whipped, thrown in jail, and put to death. Every one of the disciples was in a position to know whether or not Jesus had risen. All but one of the 11 were put to death. 6 were tortured to death through crucifixion and endured persecution, even to death, rather than recant their testimony that Jesus Christ had appeared to them and that he is the Son of God. People die for their faith all the time, right? What's the difference? It's this. People will die for their faith if they believe that it is true. But people will not die for their faith if they know that it is false. Nobody knowingly dies for a lie. The disciples were so certain of it that they staked their lives on it, and they lost their lives for it. Objection number three is the hallucination theory. The hallucination theory. So what happened to the body? Many people suggest something like a mass hallucination. These people had such an anticipation of the resurrection and were so excited about Jesus rising that they actually projected their own hallucinations because of this strong desire. They thought they saw Jesus because they wanted to see him so badly. But hallucinations are not group events. It would be like me saying to everyone right now, hey, remember that dream we had last night? Wasn't that great? You guys would all think I was crazy, right? Another thing was that they weren't expecting the resurrection. The Christ followers were crushed, perplexed, discouraged, depressed. They had lost their leader. They never expected an actual physical resurrection. According to church historians, Thomas was put to death in southern India. Thomas was the person least expecting the resurrection. He didn't believe it even when they told him. When he saw Jesus, he insisted on putting his hands in the nail prints. Years later, he wasn't about to go to his death saying, you know, hey, it may have just been a hallucination, but that's good enough for me. Objection number four is the wrong tomb theory. The wrong tomb theory. What if the disciples simply went to the wrong tomb? Right? Possible, huh? After all, it was early in the morning when these exhausted, emotionally drained, psychologically jaded disciples saw a tomb which looked like Jesus' tomb. It was empty, and they jumped for joy, thinking he was alive, and the rest is history. However, this was not a little execution. This was the biggest capital punishment rendered in all of history. It was no small execution. Crowds of people attended this crucifixion. We can tell you today the name of the person whose tomb Jesus laid in, Joseph of Arimathea. He was a leading citizen. He would have certainly pointed out that they had gone to the wrong tomb. If this was the wrong tomb, that means then there was a right tomb, right? If there was a right tomb, that means there was a body somewhere. And that means Roman authorities and Jewish leaders could have easily produced the body and crushed the growing movement. So, what are you left with? The Bible records that more than 500 witnesses saw Jesus alive. Belief in the resurrection message spread like wildfire. Timid fishermen and accountants were suddenly and radically changed, and they refused to back down on their story of seeing Christ raised from the dead. They held to their claims even in the face of horrific torture. The very same disciple who 3 days earlier had backed down and denied Jesus Christ when challenged by a servant girl, remember the story? Was now willing to stand up and declare the resurrection happened. And indeed, he went to the grave rather than renounce that he'd seen Jesus alive after his death. Jesus had, in essence, said to the crowds, "I'll prove to you that I am God by raising from the dead." And however bizarre that may seem, it looks historically like that's exactly what happened. Another evidence for the resurrection is the evidence of fulfilled prophecies. Evidence of fulfilled prophecies. Jesus said in John chapter 10, 36 through 37, "I am God's Son. Do not believe me unless I do the works of my Father." Don't believe me unless you see it. Unless you see me doing what I said I was going to do. Here's the thing. Of the 300 prophecies about Jesus' death and resurrection in scriptures, 300 of them were fulfilled. He would ride into Jerusalem on a donkey. He would be betrayed by a friend. He would be forsaken by his disciples. He would be accused by false witnesses. He would remain silent before his accusers. He would be wounded and bruised. He would be whipped and spat upon. He would be mocked. His hands and feet would be pierced. He would be crucified with thieves. People would shake their heads at him. His clothes would be divided and lots cast for them. He would be offered gall and vinegar to drink. The exact words of his death cry were predicted. Not one of his bones would be broken. His heart would literally burst. His side would be pierced. Darkness would fall in broad daylight. He would be buried in a rich man's tomb. He would be resurrected from the dead. And this is just a small portion of the 300 prophecies found in the Old Testament, and all 300 happened. Coincidence? The next evidence of the resurrection is, number three, the evidence of eyewitness accounts. The evidence of eyewitness accounts. Acts chapter 1, verse 3 reads, "After his suffering, he presented himself to them and gave many convincing proofs that he was alive." 1 Corinthians chapter 15, verses 3 through 8, Paul says, "For what I received, I passed on to you as of first importance, that Christ died for our sins according to the Scriptures, that he was buried, and that he was raised on the third day according to the Scriptures. And then he appeared to Cephas, and then to the 12. After that, he appeared to more than 500 of the brothers and sisters at the same time, most of whom are still living, though some have fallen asleep. Then he appeared to James, then to all the apostles, and last of all, he appeared to me also as to one abnormally born." The reference to 500 people, most of whom were still living, was just to seal the argument Paul was making. It would have been very easy for those people to refute him. It doesn't take much for people who want to refute a preacher. But Paul was throwing down a challenge saying, if you doubt me, there are plenty of other people around here who also saw what I saw. And lastly, is the evidence of changed lives. The evidence of changed lives. John wrote in John, verse 8:32, "Then you will know the truth, and the truth will set you free." Then you will know the truth, and the truth will set you free. This makes the resurrection personal. When you think about it, what was the initial reaction of all the disciples? They all fled. Peter went back to fishing. Mary came to the tomb that first Easter sunrise with spices. Why? Not to find a risen Savior. She came to anoint a dead body. In fact, when she first saw him, she mistook him for the gardener. When the other disciples heard what the first eyewitnesses said, they didn't believe them. When Jesus finally appeared to the disciples, their reaction was fear. They thought they were seeing a ghost. He finally had to say, "Touch me and see." Then he ate in front of them so they would know that he was alive, and he even cooked them breakfast. Finally, the classic case is Thomas the doubter. Thomas was not present when the Lord appeared to the disciples the first time, and he wasn't interested in buying what they were selling. He said, I need hard evidence to believe you guys. Now, what changed a band of frightened, discouraged, depressed followers into people of courage and conviction? What was it that changed Peter from Peter the cowardly into a confident communicator? What was it that replaced Thomas's doubt with a firmly held faith that went with him to the grave? One minute, they're defeated. The next minute, they're dynamic. One minute, they're crushed. The next minute, they're confident. One minute, they're having a pity party. The next, they're taking on the world. One minute, they're paralyzed with fear, and the next, they're filled with faith. John R.W. Stout wrote, "The transformation of the disciples is perhaps the greatest evidence of all for the resurrection." When people are expecting death but find life, it causes an uproar. This is what happened historically at the time of Christ. I recently heard a preacher who had a rural pastorate. Part of what was expected of him was to travel to rural communities around him where they didn't have churches, and so a preacher would be there for funerals, and he would go out with an undertaker and ride in the hearse. One time, they were on their way back from a funeral, and the preacher grew very tired, and he decided to crawl into the back of the car and take a nap. The funeral director driving the hearse realized while the preacher was napping that they needed gas. And at the gas station, the attendant filling the tank was a little squeamish as he looked through the window and saw a dead body laid out in the back of the hearse. But right as he was filling the tank, the preacher woke up, opened his eyes, and tried to figure out where he was. So he rose up and knocked on the glass to get the attention of the gas station attendant. The preacher later said he'd never seen anyone run so fast in all his life. When people see life where they expect death, it causes a reaction. Something triggered the birth of a worldwide movement 2,000 years ago that turned the world upside down over the span of a few years. If Jesus wasn't resurrected, what's the catalyst for this world-changing movement? One scholar said, "The coming into existence of the church rips a great hole in history, the size and shape of the resurrection." What does the secular historian propose to stop it up with? There are many, many stories of people who had an encounter with Jesus and the resurrection, and their lives were changed because of it. Edmund Bennett, who for 20 years was dean of law school at Boston University, investigated the resurrection and believed it. Frank Morrison, a journalist and lawyer, set out to disprove the resurrection. He investigated it and devoted his life to Christ as a result. Josh McDowell, as a young agnostic headed for law school, investigated the resurrection and was converted and has helped convert thousands of young agnostics. Lee Strobel, we know that name, was an award-winning legal editor at the Chicago Tribune and an atheist until he investigated the resurrection and became one of today's great apologists. John Singleton Copley, one of the greatest minds in the legal circles of England and three times Lord Chancellor of Great Britain, had a similar experience. He said, "I know what evidence is, and evidence like that for the resurrection has not broken down yet." And there are many, many, many more stories. But here's the thing. The only one who may not yet have written or declared their decision is sitting in this church right now. John wrote, "Then you will know the truth, and the truth will set you free." If you have believed these truths, then why not receive Christ today and add your story to the stories of a life changed by the resurrection of Jesus Christ? Father God, it's my prayer today that if someone is sitting in this room today, Father, that have not yet given their life to you, that they would not leave this place without doing that this morning, Father, that they would seek me or Bradley out this morning, Father, and that we could help walk them through this and give them an opportunity to make their story Father, finished in you, so that they can add their story to just the fact that their life was changed because of what you've done. Father, it's cool to walk through evidence of the resurrection and to see how plain it is, how simple it is. The fact that the disciples went from fear to faith, man, something changed. Father, continue to give us that courage to step out, to talk to others about you and the amazing story of the resurrection, because that, our faith hinders, everything hinders on the fact that you rose from the dead. So Father, as we continue to push towards that, to continue to reach out and step out, Father, we pray that more lives, more stories will be added because of what you've done over 2,000 years ago. We love you.